You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening. It's Cascadia News Now, your local eye and ear on things around you that you've heard about and maybe some that you haven't. I'm Stephanie Contouris. Joining me tonight, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. We have a whole bunch to talk about this week, some new candidates coming, and that's building up more and more about Hearst and something that's kind of got us all a little irritated under the collar. But first, if you are listening to our live Wednesday recording, I want to let you know that in about an hour, there is going to be, that's 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 19th, that there's going to be a community conversation, Issues Facing the Transgender Community. And that is hosted in part by PFLAG and Washington Won't Discriminate. You might know Washington Won't Discriminate as a mover and shaker for such greatest hits as equal marriage and domestic partnership in our town, as well as ongoing fights for equality. This event is happening at the Garden Street Methodist Church starting at 6:30, and that's 1326 North Garden Street. It's going to feature real-life stories from the Bellingham transgender community. And the event is really welcoming to those who have questions about being trans or and were afraid to ask, and also people who are really connected with trans issues. So I encourage everybody to listen to as much of this show as you can and then get down there. If you are listening to one of our repeat broadcasts, we are going to be featuring some news from that event on our next week's show. But one of the reasons that show is that event is happening tonight is it's really concerned with I-1552, which is gathering signatures, and it is once again trying to roll back equality for transgender students in our state. Okay, everybody's nodding. Like, you can't see them, everybody's nodding. So I guess everybody at the table agrees with that. But let me go into I-1552 a little bit. So this initiative was tried in previous years, and it's really about rolling back protections and protecting against hate crimes. One of the things that the groups who are putting this forward are claiming is that it's about the safety of their students, and that their students should have a place to feel safe in their bathrooms, and really trying to present this very insidious trans fear, trans threat kind of messaging with bright, shiny, happy faces of we just want to protect our children. And actually, the young people in our state who are among the most bullied and the most harassed are trans students and trans identified students. Wherever you stand on this, you actually do want people to use the bathroom of their identified gender. It's much worse for everyone if people are not able to do that and don't have the freedom to do that.
You know, my comment on this would be that, you know, as part of my function with the newspaper, I comb through the police reports. And I comb through them for all of the cities of Whatcom County and Skagit County, Mount Vernon, Anacortes, Bellingham, Blaine, Linden, Ferndale, and there are just no reports of problems of this issue. So this is a solution in search of a problem. The sorts of things that you might be concerned about people being harassed are already against the law. I mean, they're already, you can't, no matter who you are, you can't go into a public restroom and berate and belittle and spy on people. I mean, it's already illegal. And so, I mean, honestly, if someone can produce a police report of an incident like this happening in the last, let's say, 10 months, I'd be interested in seeing it because there are none.
Send it to the Cascadia Weekly, folks. But here's the thing that's even more frustrating. Not only do they use this insidious language about, oh, a young girl might be harassed by a transgender man when everybody's the same age student, but they play on words. But the men who have entered bathrooms were the men supporting this initiative that were going in and harassing people themselves in order to get signatures for this initiative in the last round.
Well, and there's a gigantic constituency everywhere, it seems, in this country of people who are really just staying up all night worrying about what's happening in other people's pants. And I think that this is just something that we're going to have in our society for a while. But it's really kind of galling to me that we're going through this once again. But on the other hand, I'm kind of happy that it seems like we have successfully moved the line. You know, this we're not fighting over marriage equality anymore. Now we're, you know, fighting over this. And when we're done fighting over this, there'll be something else that's also appalling. But it feels at least like progress to see nonsense like this.
Yeah, I honestly think that I think history and time and our society has moved on and we're in a different place. But the thing that people have to understand about these wedge issues, they get people opening up their checkbooks and writing big checks. And that's the whole purpose of it. You talk about taking people's guns away, checkbook comes out. You talk about, somebody asserting, threatening children somehow, the checkbooks come out and you write a big check. And so this is a mechanism. These wedge issues are a mechanism by which, you know, conservative groups, you know, continue to get money coming into their coffers so they can do political action in the United States.
And yet, look at those organizations that have fallen down and closed up shop. The family, whatever they call themselves, family organizations that play on that word in order to be anti-marriage, they closed up shop. Like, it didn't work. Although I have to take issue a little bit, Tim, because with the current administration, I think that some of those issues are not quite as cut and dry wrapped up as they should be. So the good thing, I think, like Dave is talking about, the good thing is that it keeps people who care about civil rights issues, trans and LGBTQ rights issues, awake and aware that they are mobilized too, and that cannot be a good thing for the upcoming election.
I think that's an excellent point, and it's important that we have things like this that keep people active and keep people moving, because when we think that things are solved, problems happen. You know, right now nationally there is a huge immigration roundup happening that didn't require changing a single federal law. All of what's happening now, all of the awful things that are happening, is legal under current law. It was just interpreted differently when we had a different administration in the White House. So I think there was some complacency that, oh, this doesn't happen here anymore, and so we don't need to worry about that quite as much. So I think you're right. I think it is good that we have things reminding us of that.
So Cascadia News now taking a strong no stand on 1552, as you should, decline to sign. We will hear more about that meeting at in our next show. Another fast update, the hunger strike in Tacoma. Sort of a nice segue that you gave me there, and I completely dropped. But the hunger strike in Tacoma at the Northwest Detention Center is continuing and growing. According to NWDC Resistance, yesterday, the women's section of the Northwest Detention Center joined the hunger strike. They're protesting both ICE and the private company, GEO. Again, some of their needs are meeting nutrition basics. They claim that is not happening. Improved medical attention, faster legal process for detainees. And we are going to have a report on that next week as well.
Well, I think this plays back into what Dave was saying, which is that rights that are not constantly defended and constantly asserted tend to evaporate, and they can evaporate pretty quickly. The reality is that even people who are undocumented in our society are here, perhaps not under completely legal circumstances. They still have rights in our society. That's been a position of the United States Supreme Court for more than a century. And I appreciate the fact that these people are standing up and are demonstrating that they have rights and that these rights are important.
Absolutely. And I want to point out, as much as I would be so happy to put this all on the feet of the current administration, that this is another hunger strike, that one happened in 2014, and our former president, Barack Obama, did deport a lot of people and did have a lot of people in detention centers. And I think it leads to a bigger issue about what's considered small petty crimes, and any excuse to detain somebody, any excuse to rip somebody from their family.
Right. Well, you know, there's been a bill in the U.S. Senate for probably 10 years now. I mean, at least, and it was there when Barack Obama was president. It's there when Trump's president, but it was an immigration reform bill. And it's only the result of the complete paralysis and ineptness of our federal government that it hasn't come to the floor of both houses for a vote, up or down. Just let's talk about it. Let's stop monkeying around with this issue, because there is a bill. It was approved by the Senate. I don't think it's been approved by the House. I don't know that it would be approved by the House in its current configuration. But, you know, this sort of paralysis that happens in our federal government, where things that are important actually never come to the floor for a vote, it's annoying as a citizen to watch that.
Well, and it's a bill that once had bipartisan support.
Correct.
Until, you know, it seemed more advantageous not to. And I think that's an excellent point. And this would be a really great opportunity to see some sort of vocal leadership from some of our state delegation, in case anyone out there feels like asking for that from their member of the state delegation. It would be nice to see them stepping up on this.
So there are some calls to action that I think are absolutely important, as frustrating as it may seem sometimes, that are maybe some of our federal representatives seem powerless, but we've seen over and over again that consistent pressure from the public does make a difference. Additionally, NWDC, the Northwest Detention Center Resistance, is calling on people to call the City of Tacoma's finance department to revoke their license with the private prison GO, and also calling on ICE as well. As I said, we are going to have more about that coming up on our next show. We hope to have a special report, but in the meantime, I can't think of much more of a sacrifice than going without food to make a point. And I think that the conditions are much worse there. I haven't seen them, but I think the conditions are much worse there than many of us realize. So my heart goes out to the people that are there and the people that are supporting them. And you are listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE, and we will be right back after this. Conflict is a part of life. We experience it at home, at work, in our schools, with family, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. The way we approach it can make the difference between escalating disagreements or peaceful resolutions. Are you facing a conflict? Unsure how to handle it? Do you need support with a difficult conversation? The Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center is here to help. Through our mission of providing and promoting constructive and collaborative approaches to conflict, the WDRC offers mediation, training, facilitation, and community education services. While conflict and violence permeate the media, our homes, and our county, we are dedicated to becoming a community where we approach conflict in creative and healthy ways. If you're experiencing conflict, want to build communication skills, or contribute to peace building, contact the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center, your local resource for creative conflict resolution services. Call us at 360-676-0122 or visit our website at www.whatcomdrc.org.
Women's Spirit Coalition, eliminating violence against Native women and promoting the well-being of Native families and communities. We envision a nation where Native women live safely and where Women's Spirit Coalition is the leader in ending violence against Native women. You can find us on Facebook at Women's Spirit Coalition or online at womensspirit.net.
You're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with my co-hosts, Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. And now, once again, it's time for us to revisit the ongoing discussion of wells in Whatcom County. But there's some slightly new updates in line with the county council meeting that just happened last night. Tim, do you want to give us an update?
Well, I think the main way to frame this is that it's becoming increasingly clear to county governments, not just Whatcom County, but throughout Washington, that this legislative fix that they wanted is probably not going to happen. I'm not sure it can even happen at this point. I think we're too far along in the legislative session for this to come back. And the county still needs to craft a response because this issue has been remanded back to the Washington State Growth Management Hearings Board. They're going to ask for a response from Whatcom County. Whatcom County needs to have an answer in place. So I think that the council is struggling to come up with this mechanism to raise the moratorium in some manner, in some fashion, that is currently in place about so-called exempt wells in Whatcom County so that people can continue to build their dream home or whatever it is that they're trying to do. But there needs to be something in place which I always get confused about because I don't think it's that difficult of an issue, but the county has to be able to demonstrate that they're permitting rural development in places where there's adequate water supply. So they have to be able to make that demonstration. And they wanted to dodge that through this so-called legislative fix. But I would think that the county honestly
would legislative fix is?
Was basically say, well, what you think is a problem is no longer a problem. But I would think that the county would want some mechanism whereby they have ultimate knowledge and control over making sure that growth happens where growth ought to happen in Whatcom County.
So backing up a bit, this has been an ongoing issue that transcends this county council as
Correct.
It stands.
And counties. All counties.
And counties and has grown. And the players are our county council, the Growth Management Act, individual people who have purchased land and thought that they could build a well on the land, and also developers. Am I missing any players in this?
Well, yeah, you are. You're missing maybe the most important players of all, which are the people that have senior water rights, whose water rights are being impaired
right.
because there's a drawdown on water capacity as a result of this issue.
And who are those people?
Well, those would be the tribes. It would be people that have had a water right for a long time. So this could be very, very large farms. It could be people that actually jumped through the hoops and went through the process and actually got themselves a real water right. Because what you have to understand about the term permit exempt wells means that they are or they were formerly exempt from the need to have a water right.
So they the county granted those.
Ecology actually is the one that
okay.
granted that, and they granted it because they believed, and I think this was a perfectly fine belief in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, and maybe even the 1980s, that rural development, home development in Washington State was a good thing. And I think they still believe that. But there are other forces at work, including fish habitat and the rights of other municipalities and tribes, whatnot, to their access to water. There are competing interests that as water becomes more and more scarce, become bigger and bigger issues.
As there's more population and the demands
right.
on water is greater, and I hear you saying that maybe it was fine to have those ideas and maybe it was fine to have those values decades ago, but I don't know that either the implications of water usage were really as thoroughly understood or maybe not as clearly. I don't want to say that they're not as clearly fought for. I think that when they were fought for, I mean, I have the vaguest remembrance of Slade Gordon. And I think when they were fought for, they were the tribes were slapped down pretty fast.
Right. Well, it's true that science marches on, and these issues, these understanding of what's called hydrological continuity, the relationship between groundwater and water that flows through rivers is more understood. It's better understood. Part of the issue has been, you know, back in the 70s, you know, maybe Whatcom County was maybe, you know, this 80,000. Now it's, you know, two times that. And so there are more demands. There are more claims on water. People think that because it rains a lot, that there must be a lot of water in the ground. But that's not necessarily true, and it's not necessarily usable. And what is usable may already be claimed because, you know, if you stack up all of the water claims in Whatcom County, they far exceed the capacity of water in Whatcom County. So what are you going to do about that?
Right. And in the meantime, there were people as some of the people who went to county council last night who were people who thought that they had these rights, and they understand that they bought this plot of land and they should have the water that land is sitting over, regardless of whether or not it flows, and are quite irate. But it's my understanding that the county council did vote to extend the moratorium again. Barbara Brenner and Ken Mann voted against that, but that carried. And then, as you were saying, that they did draft a letter to the legislature. As you said, it's probably too late, but Councilman Weimer, and we're hoping to talk to him next week, but Councilman Weimer said to me that he had some pretty hefty amendments to that letter to bring the Department of Ecology back into it and bring their sort of responsibility back into it.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is ultimately the county wants to have a state partner in this decision-making. They don't want to go it alone. They don't want to be liable alone. I think they have partnerships. I think they have partnerships with all the Washington counties that are struggling with this issue and trying to come up with a resolution for it. You know, I think that where the county council is concerned is one of the things that they wanted to make sure is that anybody that had a project that was, I use the word advisedly, in the pipeline, anything that was in the pipeline, they wanted to make sure that those people's projects could move forward, and that people didn't have trapped assets or trapped aspirations. They weren't halfway into construction of a home, and then suddenly they're foreclosed upon. They can't move forward. You know, the interesting thing to me about this problem is I think it is solvable. And people say, well, you know, why are we focused on rural well owners when they're only a fraction of the water use because agriculture is the big water user? Well, you don't use the problems that can't be solved as an excuse to not to deal with the problems that can be solved. And I think that there is a potential for a solution here. One of the potential solutions is that all of the water associations of Whatcom County could play a partnership role in helping these residential rural homeowners get access to water. And I think one of the things that I think is happening is everybody wants this quick legislative fix. You know, I'll just say that a problem that is a problem is no longer a problem. But actually, I think the more lasting and durable solution is to get all of these groups and associations together and to come up with something that really provides adequate and ample water for Whatcom County homeowners.
If it can be provided.
If it can be provided, yes.
Which is, I think, the most important thing to establish right away. And I think it's good to be heading down that road. This is one of those things that should have been done a long time ago. And like you mentioned, a lot of these assumptions were from the time when the attitude was, well, there's always more. There's always more trees. There's always more this. And we've learned a lot.
And Tim, I think that's an excellent solution. And you have been a watchful eye on both the city and county councils for at least a couple of decades now. I think you should run. I think you've got a great solution. You've got a great platform. You have probably more experience than many people in the county.
But if I was in office, I wouldn't be able to write about it.
Well, that's true. Then we'd be stuck with us. Okay, well, we're going to be paying more attention, whether we want to or not. We're going to pay ongoing attention to this issue because it's an ongoing and complex issue, and hope to be talking to some experts about that in the future. But that's the update for now. And we are going to turn to the state, since the county council wrote a letter to the legislature. What is happening with the legislature, Dave?
Well, things are still moving. There's still some bills working their way through. The big thing, of course, is still the budget. And I don't think at this point anyone is under any illusions about having a budget before the deadline. They're still deadlocked on the conference between the State House and Senate. The state Republicans want the Democrats to go on record voting for the funding packages that they want to finance their budget before they sit down to negotiate.
Can I ask what some of that includes that they're having a
That's a new capital gains tax, a total reshuffle of business taxes that would eliminate business taxes on a lot of smaller businesses and raise them on some larger businesses. And they want to make the Democrats uncomfortable and go on record, because that's that's an electoral thing. That's something that they can hammer them about later. And the negotiations over the education plan are still happening. They're still meeting a few times a week. But since that's all so deeply intertwined with the budget, we're really not going to have one without the other. And nobody's really saying it yet, but it's starting to kind of feel like we're kicking this can down the road a little further. We're going to wind up with a, smaller budget proposal that's not as sweeping and drastic as either the governor or the House or the Senate was talking about. And we'll fix education next time. So
Tim was talking about that majority group that had sort of disbanded. And then you were talking about, this is in previous weeks, that you were talking about, Dave, that people were getting along better. And I had some hope that maybe that would equate with a forward motion in our legislature.
I think that there's a better attitude overall, but people are still playing games the way they always do. And in some ways, I think there's a little bit of last gasp happening, because right now, chances are not great that the Senate is going to stay controlled by state Republicans for the next session. So I think they're trying to extract some more pain and concessions while they can.
Yeah, and I think that the so-called majority caucus coalition, it wasn't disbanded, but it kind of collapsed. It collapsed as a result of some electoral changes in November. What I think is happening is everybody, if you remember, people that might have remembered this, Khrushchev took his shoe off in the United Nations and beat it on a pulpit. And everybody took their shoe off and they beat it. And they all made their pronouncements to their constituency that they were going to do this and they're going to do that. And I think that they have thrown their tantrums. And I do think that the adults are starting to assert themselves, because it's a drag.
I really want to ask you who the adults are.
Well,
are you going to go on record and say who the adults are?
I'm going to go on record. There's an adult inside everyone, and there's a child inside everyone. And I think the adult inside everyone down in Olympia is starting to assert itself, because it is a real drag to have to extend a session and continue to drive down to Olympia and do this stuff. And I think it wears on them personally. And, I would hope that they would have higher values than their own personal discomfort at coming back and would actually do things on behalf of the public and the public good. But if the motivation is that they don't want to be, driving down to Olympia through July, maybe right. That's good.
And you know what's really frustrating to me, Dave, you're talking about posturing. And every year that we go into a special session and everybody gets paid a per diem, and that's costing our government a whole bunch of money that we don't have. And on one hand, the Democrats are like, and the Republicans wouldn't resolve the budget, and that's costing the state money. And the Republicans say the exact same thing about the Democrats. And so that's used as this bludgeon, and yet the whole state's paying this money that we can't afford to pay.
Yeah, and I think absolutely. And to tie that in, I think it's weighing on them politically as well.
Yeah.
I mean, already this year, started to see in some local papers around the state some letters to the editor about how much special sessions cost. And that happens every single time, but it's a little early this year. And I think people are just getting fed up with it over and over again.
Yeah, I think they are too. And you know, it's and I've made this point before, but when one party has a lot of things they want to do and the other party has only one thing that they're interested in, it makes it very difficult to negotiate. And does that mean that this side that only has one thing always wins? Because I don't think that's good for our society. And that's kind of what happens, because the Democrats have a lot of things they want to get done. The Republicans have one goal, which is not to raise taxes.
Absolutely. You are listening to KMRE 102.3 Bellingham, Washington, or maybe joining us from anywhere in the world on KMRE.org. Welcome. This is Cascadia News Now. That was Tim Johnson, and I'm Stephanie Contouris and Dave Willingham giving us the legislative update. The session is supposed to end April 23rd. Sounds like we'll be talking about this again next week. So let's move on for now. I just want to give a couple of plugs. If you are listening to this Wednesday, then you might want to go down Thursday, April 20th, as Spark Museum. That's our home and our parent organization at KMRE. And they are the beneficiary of a Goat Mountain Pizza fundraiser. All you have to do on April 20th is go in, eat a piece of pizza. If you do not like gluten, you can eat one of their wonderful salads or have a beer. And you donate that receipt to just drop it in a box, and a portion will go to keeping Spark Museum and KMRE alive. So that is part of the March for Science, April 22nd. And there's a whole bunch of events happening in Bellingham. But let's take a moment and say yay to science.
Yay, science. I'm starting to feel like this has become marching season, right? It seems like we just had one last week. There's another one coming up. I mean, we've already got initiative season and conference season. This is getting a little out of hand.
I like the fact that there's advocacy for science, but I dislike the fact that we have to think that there must be advocacy for science. It's very difficult for me to think that science needs to have a march in support of it. But that said, I'm glad that we're having a march in support of science.
Exactly. I mean, I don't recall ever having any pro-science rallies or publicity events in my life. I think I remember Skylab falling on somebody's head, and that's about it.
But will there be dinosaurs in this march?
I don't know. They did coexist with us. So you never know what could show up at a march for science. But I think, obviously, we are in the Spark Museum. We are all pro-science, regardless of what other beliefs we may or may not have. Testing things, making discoveries, having hypotheses, and proving or disproving those hypotheses is integral to the human condition. And that's who we are. Discovering things is who we are. Aside from all the wonders of being able to even speak to you through a microphone and that you can hear me in the Ukraine, as we have a listener in the Ukraine, but aside from all of the medical progress that we make, why am I even making a case for science? I don't know that I have to make a case for science. But anyway, the March for Science is April 22nd, and you can find out more online or on Facebook. Just look up March for Science. There's going to be a whole bunch of stuff happening, and our local officials are going to be involved. Speaking of science, or maybe not, I just wanted to touch in very briefly on the mistrial for the BNR railway trespassers. There was a mistrial. Let me back up. So the group Break Free Pacific Northwest, back a year ago last spring, does everybody remember the Kayaktivists? This was part of the whole Kayaktivist movement, which is such an inherently Northwest thing that it's pretty delightful just from that aspect alone. But there were hundreds of people that came from around the Sound, and they were protesting oil. They were protesting. There was part of the Shell oil and some of the oil refineries. Well, some people were lying on the railway tracks, and so there were some arrests. And there have been two groups previously that were penalized. They were found guilty and received second-degree criminal trespass. But this group, one of the jurors, there was a hung jury. They deliberately could not make a decision. One of the jurors, after the fact, told the protesters how much they loved them and supported them, which completely threw the trial out.
You know, this is interesting. It's fascinating to see these things end in a mistrial, because there are laws in the books that forbid certain kinds of behaviors. But in our society, we have a right that transcends all of that, which is the right to gather and freely protest and speak our minds and ask for redress of grievances. And so there's a huge conflict that goes on when you ask a jury to simultaneously uphold the laws of the state of Washington and the Constitution. And I'm not too surprised to hear that people struggle with that issue, because clearly these people in their actions were not doing it for their own personal enrichment. They weren't doing it to better themselves personally, to get a better job. They had a belief that these projects are a threat to our environment, to human health and safety. And they met in a way that's enshrined in the First Amendment, which is they exercise this right that we have in our society. And then a jury is asked to render a verdict, and it's difficult for them to render a verdict. And, you know, I've made this point before, but we have a lot of patience in our society for the Second Amendment. I mean, people die by the dozens in the United States every day because we have this strange commitment to an oddball reading, in my view, of the Second Amendment. And I think we should have a little deference and patience with the First Amendment.
And to expand on that, this also reflects, I think, one of the good things about our justice system, which in a lot of ways is like a magic eye painting, but the closer you look, just the weirder and more terrible it becomes. But
I've never heard magic eye paintings described that way.
There's this concept of juror nullification, which is you have a right to a jury trial in certain circumstances, and those jurors are instructed to uphold the law. But their decision is their decision, and that is the decision of the court. And that's an important right and an important facet of our society. And it's not often used, but it's been used in drug cases. It's been used in political cases. And it's I think it's an important kind of safety valve on some of the crazier parts of our justice system.
Absolutely. And I want to point out that the ages, there were people in their 60s and 70s at these protests, but a lot of young people. And when I hear that millennials don't care or they're apathetic, I don't think people are paying attention to environmental issues.
Yeah, and I'm happy to hear that jurors are they're not unaware of this too.
Right.
And they're part of our society too, and they perform a vital function. Everybody that serves on a jury should be honored for their service. And I think this jury that came to a mistrial, they were as noble as any jury can be.
And as an aside, if you ever don't want to serve on a jury, and you should serve on juries. That's important. And it's just a part of being an American that you should embrace and enjoy as much as you can. But if you ever want to get out, bring a stack of pamphlets about juror nullification, and they will escort you from the building.
I thought you weren't even allowed to talk about it without, you know, some magic genies coming down and erasing you from the face of the earth or something. I mean, it's kind of has some scary stuff around it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really makes you feel empowered when you're in a room, in a building that is designed to impose, and people are afraid of what you might say.
But I have to say, like, I understand what you're saying, but no, you should not ever get out of being a juror. And it's something here. I'm going to go into my little pre-rant. We have another rant scheduled. But man, I mean, if you're facing extreme circumstances, if you're having family medical crises, if your job is crucial to the lives of the people of this community, then that's one thing. But people who just don't want to be on a jury, first of all, like, it's the least you could do. It's so crucial to our judicial process that we have supposed peers. I mean, not exactly peers, but we have supposed peers sitting there. So it's not just judicial insiders who are making those decisions about you. And it's really fascinating. Not only should you just not ever try to get out of jury duty just because it's wrong, but it's really fascinating, and you're missing out on this whole world that, unless you're involved in the legal system, you don't really know about. So that was my pre-rant. Now let's get into our real rant. So the story that is attached to this is that the city of Bellingham last week announced a pedestrian safety education campaign. Now, this is with the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, the WSCT. Their goal is zero collisions in Bellingham. They're taking measures to reduce collisions. If you look into the press release, you will see that they are, I don't want to say aiming and I don't want to say targeting, but those are the words that are coming to my head, that they're focusing on pedestrians and drivers. But the fact that it's called the Pedestrian Safety Education Campaign makes it sound like they're blaming the victim to me. And Tim and Dave and I are all pedestrians frequently, and it couldn't happen at a better time. I think I could start by saying that.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, this is, yeah, we are going to rant because, you know, I personally, in the last 18 months, have been almost killed in traffic downtown, crossing the street when the light was in my favor, probably about 5 or 6 times. And the statistic that was presented at the council meeting is, in the last 2 months, there have been 4 civilians who were in, you know, pedestrians who were in the crosswalk with the right-of-way who were struck, one of which was fatal.
Wow. And in Bellingham.
In Bellingham.
In 2 months.
Yes, and it's a growing problem. I'd like to talk about my own opinion about it, but the city of Bellingham, in their presentation, they put out some statistics that were interesting. You come across on this from two things. One is that they try to do a demographic of all the pedestrians that were struck, and they're all over the map, which means that it's completely random, which means these are just people who are randomly struck.
It's not octogenarians.
Yes.
It's not
correct.
Right.
And when you look at the drivers now, then you start to see a pattern, which means that there is a certain kind of driver doing certain kinds of things versus, you know, completely random association of pedestrians.
Are we talking about people texting while driving?
Well, the demographics that were used were essentially, I'll call them out here, males between the ages of 20 to 30. The most primary cause of the collision was failure to yield to the right of way and inattentiveness, and those two things. And then you can draw some inferences from some of the information that was out there, which is most of the injuries have occurred on high-speed arterials. So speed is obviously a factor there. And I think the other thing that's going on is presumption of right-of-way. But the point I would want to make that they didn't make at the council that I think is important is I think there's a lot of almost near collisions in downtown, the downtown core.
Yep.
But I think the speeds are lower. And I think one of the reasons why these collisions are occurring on arterials and they're showing up as blips in a demographic is because those are the speeds are higher and the consequences are much more devastating.
So it's difficult to stop. And people who are driving downtown, one would hope, are having to pay more attention because there's more action everywhere around them. Whereas if somebody's on an arterial, maybe it's easier to pay less attention.
Right. You know, and it's fun because I go to these meetings and I'm comparing the perception of staff and their data versus my own personal anecdotal information. But my own personal anecdotal information is I think there's a couple of factors in Bellingham that make Bellingham particularly egregious in terms of pedestrian safety. One is there's this preponderance of one-way streets. And I think those encourage a higher speed. But also, I can't tell you how many times I've been waiting in a crosswalk, and the person is waiting there to make their free right, and they're only looking to the left because they're only concerned right. about the traffic that's coming from the left. And you can't even get them to look at you standing on that side of the sidewalk. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, I basically do not cross in front of cars. In that circumstance, I walk from the car back behind. I do not cross because that car is ready the moment that they feel that they have a free right to rock it out there and to take their free right. What's interesting to me is that same driver will not rock it through an intersection straight through if you're in the crosswalk. It's only on these turns, on these this free right turn. So I think there may
that's
be.
That's actually, I mean, that's happened to us. When Dave and I were walking downtown to see a show at Mount Pinker Theater, and there was somebody who was at a stop, who was facing us, and we were in the crosswalk at a stop sign, not distracted, not texting, looking at us, started towards us. And we just turned and looked at them like, are you freaking kidding me?
And that's I've had that experience,
but
too.
But the thing is this is goes to your point about who's doing it and why. I am used to the polite Bellingham driver. I believe the hype about the polite Bellingham driver. How many of us have waited at a four-way stop? No, you go. No, and everybody's like so polite. All of a sudden, that's disappearing. And the people who are trying to hit me, if I stop and look at them and say, oh, you know, Holly, here I am, have this insolent look on their faces like, what are you going to do about it? I'm in a car. And that's the part that freaks me out.
Yeah. And that was the second point was I think there's a complete misperception about the right of way and about pedestrians in the right of way, because no matter what, right, a pedestrian always has the right of way. And there's a reason for that. Because the consequence of not yielding to a pedestrian is a fatality.
Right.
And so – and
Or great right. gross
and,
injury.
And so I'm not trying to say that pedestrians sometimes don't step out and surprise drivers or do things. Pedestrians can do silly things, goofy things, stupid things. But, you know, they always have the right-of-way. And a car needs to yield to the right-of-way. Otherwise, it's a fatality, and nobody wants that, you know. But I think the – and then – you know, the next thing on a hierarchy I would put probably is the high speed.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in my perception, one of the most dangerous intersections in Bellingham is Holly Street and Railroad because there's a lot of traffic there and people are coming down that one-way hill and the lights are synchronous. And so you can get a big speed up going down there and then somebody steps out into traffic. None of these collisions have occurred in the downtown core, but I see them every day and I've almost been a victim to them.
But
many
a lot
times.
Of almost collisions have, and I don't know that is being tracked.
Right.
Well, and it used to be in this country, and it wasn't that long ago, that the roads were for pedestrians. And if you were in a car, it was up to you to be aware of where all the pedestrians were. And that changed as it became, you know, the values of the country changed, and it became a value to have everybody in a car, which has led to us now building a society where everyone almost has to have a car, which means that if you can identify someone who shouldn't be driving, it is difficult to take their license away. In a just society, people who are not safe would not own cars. They wouldn't be able to because they're dangerous. But to do that is to, you know, it's to commit an act of violence against them. You've harmed their livelihood. You've, you know, made it very difficult for them to live because of the way we've built this society.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we just have a minute left. I think this is a rant that will come back again, and we have a lot more to say. But the going back to this plan from the city to educate people, how are they going to make people be educated? Is this going to be effective?
Well, there's the three E's, what they call. It's education, enforcement, and engineering. And engineering is building safer crosswalks. I think that they've done that. The thing that's frustrating about this is almost all of these – I mean all of these collisions that have occurred in a crosswalk when the light is with the pedestrian, the pedestrian has the right of way, and all of these things were failure to yield to that condition. So I don't think engineering is going to solve the problem, because I think that people are crossing there. So the other things are education, enforcement. Well, you can educate people, but actually I think the Bellingham police need to get an awareness of people who are abusing their so-called free right turn, because they only have a free right if there's nothing impeding that right. It's not a right. It's the ability to make a turn when something is not blocking or impeding or risking.
Right. Well, police enforcement is a whole other ball of wax that I'm sure we will get into in the future. We are going to turn to a review, jumping back a little bit. Dave, you said there was a lot of marches going on, and our own Rosa Tobin was at the Seattle Tax Day March, and she had some mixed feelings about it. Let's hear from Rosa.
April 15th, across the nation, people hit the streets for the tax march. So I joined them with around 30 other folks from Bellingham, all of us with one destination, Seattle. Before the march began, the streets were filled with new and old marchers alike.
I fight for the resistance every day. I'm retired and I feel like that's what I do. I get up every day and fight for the resistance.
We all gathered to good music and chanting. Lots of chanting.
No more secrets, no more lies. Show your taxes, show your ties. No more secrets, no more lies.
Show your taxes, show your ties.
So the average start to a march.
So today we're going to hear from a diverse group of voices, and then we're going to march so that our voices can be heard.
Event organizers brought together a powerful group of speakers for the event to kick off the march. There were 13 different groups and speakers representing different organizations and causes, including North Seattle Indivisible, All In for Washington, NARAL Pro-Choice Washington, The Socialist Alternative, Health Equity Seattle, and that's only naming a few of the different organizations and causes these speakers work for on a daily basis. Speakers including powerful progressives like Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
Taxes are what allow us to invest in our common good. They are what allow us to have schools and roads and all of the things that matter to a society to really have a democracy. But our tax system has to be fair. People have to pay their fair share. You can't have the lowest income people paying the most, which is what happens here in Washington State. The most regressive tax system in the country, where the highest income people pay 2.7% of their income in taxes, the lowest 20% pay 17%. That's just wrong. That's not how it should be. So we need to make sure that we are fixing that unfair tax system, both here in the state and nationally. But we also know that tax returns tell the story of our financial lives. And that is why when we elect a president to the United States of America, we want to see his tax returns, because we want to make sure that he is acting not in his own financial interest for his investments to increase, but in the interests of the American people. That is why it matters. And that is why every single president in modern history has released their tax returns, until Donald Trump. No more sitting back, people, because this is our time, our world, our air and water, our schools, our roads, our transit, our civil rights, and our country.
These speakers highlighted how taxes are not an isolated topic, but are pervasive in our social, racial, environmental, and educational spheres. They highlighted how these are all interconnected issues. However, not everyone saw having such a long and diverse list of speakers as a positive addition to the event. With each passing speaker, the crowd got antsier, and emotions came to a head when it was announced that representatives from the Block the Bunker Coalition would be speaking after Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
When our democracy is under attack, what do we do? Oh, you guys got this. Okay, so speaking of standing up and fighting back, we have to create a little bit of space for one more group of speakers today. I know.
Maybe it was because the crowd had been promised Pramila Jayapal would be the last speaker. One marcher, Rich Smith, reflected on the situation in an article he wrote for Seattle's newspaper, The Stranger, stating for reasons that made absolutely no sense to him, Block the Bunker Coalition spoke after Congresswoman Jayapal.
But let me tell you, this is what resistance looks like. And we have a young group of activists who have been leading the way in social justice and resistance. Please join me in welcoming the Block the Bunker Coalition. Thank you.
Hi, this is Yin with Block the Bunker. I just want to say that first we were invited to speak, so we are not taking up extra space. I want to acknowledge that we are, like what my sister Zarna has said, we are on stolen Duwamish land. This is the we are occupying the Duwamish, Suquamish, Snohomish, Muckoshu, and many nations that we do not know existed here because of colonization. And that's how we want to start our conversation.
So when we think about using resources, we should put it in the communities themselves.
Hey, people who are choosing to leave right now, what are you doing? We know you want to march. You all are ready to march, right? And we're community organizers who do this on a daily, and we're here to speak to you before you start marching. So give us a few minutes, okay? I want to make clear that all immigrants and refugees are refugees, a social, economic, and political pain and trauma that has been done to our lands by capitalist, imperialistic, colonial, white supremacist, patriarchal, cis heteronormative systems of power that our tax codes feed.
I don't know if you caught that last bit, but an adult white male yelled, "You're preaching to the choir," cutting off the young woman of color activist speaking with the Block the Bunker Coalition. Then, just minutes after this tension surfaced, we all started marching. And that was that. There were a few thousand of us on the streets. Passers-by stopped to watch and cheer. There was more chanting.
The people united will never be divided! The people united will never be divided!
But I found myself wondering, for that mile of a march, what is the resistance? It can't just be physically showing up to march, can it? When we have the opportunity, like we did this past Saturday, to gather together and hear the voices of so many political organizers and activists who've been in this movement for years, does joining the resistance mean just stepping off the curb and onto the street? Or does joining the resistance mean joining a communal conversation, both as chanters and as listeners? For Cascadia News Now, I'm Rosa Tobin.
Rosa Tobin, embedded with the Tax March bus last week, and you're listening to Cascadia News Now, was joined by my ongoing co-host, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham, and we hope to walk safely for another week, but we will certainly be talking about that issue more as well. Want to give you a couple of plugs before we wrap up the show. Dave has his own show, and he's looking at international and national news. Tune into the American Carnage Report here on KMRE, Mondays at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. So you've got two times there. Dave's talking about some pretty big stuff on the national level. Also, you want to join and maybe beat the Cascadia News Now trivia team. That's right. We are going to be playing, me and Tim and Dave and our engineer Devlin. We're playing Goat Mountain Trivia. It's a benefit for KMRE. That's next Wednesday, April 26th. Please join us. We think you can beat us, but we'll see what happens. It's Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m., just $5. Support the station. And you are listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris. We want to thank our citizen journalist, Rosa Tobin, our engineer, Devlin Sweeney. And if you want to hear back archives, you can listen, find us on CascadiaNewsNow.com. Get in touch with us on Facebook at Cascadia News Now. And stay listening to KMRE Bellingham, KMRE.org.